I would like to acknowledge my co-authors as well as all the volunteers who participated in completing this. Susan Kelly, who is a vision scientist at the Illinois College of Optometry. Paul Berman is the senior global advisor for the Special Olympics Lions Club's International Opening Eyes Program. And all of the volunteers who participated in the early years that we started to work at the Special Olympics Lions Club Opening Eyes Program. So the title of my presentation relates to the attitudes of optometrists and optometry students towards persons with intellectual disability after they participate in our program. The reality is the attitude measurement is thought to be very critical to explaining and predicting behavior. We feel very strongly that oftentimes attitude dictates what people do in their lifestyles. Inherent in attitude research is the notion that once the attitude's underlying behaviors are known, then it can be more likely that appropriate interventions to change these attitudes can be applied. Thinking about that as a focusing point, that's what created our thought process in, do we think that there are negative attitudes towards persons with intellectual disabilities, and what are the barriers to ensuring that access to eye care services for this population can be addressed? So that is a little bit of the background as to why we did the survey. The study essentially was a survey looking at attitudes of optometrists and optometry students towards persons with intellectual disability. Now, we did that based on prognostications, and I'll go through that a little bit as I go through the survey. Our hypothesis is that if an optometrist participates in the Special Olympics Lions Club International Opening Eyes Program, we can potentially change attitudes or improve their responses or understanding of persons with intellectual disability from a number of different perspectives. Our feeling from our hypothesis is that we utilize our screening program as almost a laboratory environment for individuals who may be uncomfortable to come and participate to break some of the barriers if those attitudes are issues. So those are some of the background and the hypotheses for doing this survey. We utilized an instrument titled the Prognostic Belief Scale, or the PBS. It's a survey that supposedly indirectly measures how someone feels or what their attitude is about dealing with individuals with varying levels of intellectual disability. Now, the reality is when you deal with this population, 95% of them are at the mild level. But we wanted to know what people thought of capabilities of this population at multiple levels. So the PBS is set up in a very specific format. There are 27 items on the first section of the PBS, which look at activities of daily living. And I'm going to go through the individual items because I think it brings home the point of how we determined what the scores were. So we'll get to what, you know, it gives you a sense of what those scores really do. And the second part of the PBS looks at things related to what you thought a person with intellectual disability could do as it relates to jobs and living environments. And I'm not addressing any of that data within this presentation today. So the prognostic belief scale starts out with a universal statement. It says we would like to know what you feel about the capabilities of somebody with mild mental retardation. By mild mental retardation, we specifically specify that these are adults with below average intelligence in the range of 55 to 75 IQ and deficits in adaptive behavior. We use that explanation because the age range of the individuals that were being surveyed might have related to ID level by IQ, and other people might have related to it by adaptive level, so that there is some change in philosophy as to how you refer to someone with intellectual disability. So what we asked them to do simply for three levels is to check what they felt a person is capable of doing. Now, I want you to listen to some of the things that are addressed here, and you'll see that there's a lot of diversity. Dressing and toileting independently, entering into a marriage contract, drinking from a cup unassisted, cooking a meal unsupervised, raising children, finding their way around unfamiliar surroundings, using a lock and key, indicating symptoms verbally to a physician, budgeting for monthly expenses, eating with utensils, doing their own laundry, making change for a dollar, telling time, having an intimate sexual relationship, filling a job application out, participating in a simple conversation, using public transportation independently, recognizing traffic and exit signs, scheduling daily activities independently, using a pay telephone, I don't know if that's such a valid thing anymore, choosing appropriate clothes to wear, following a national news event, acting appropriately towards strangers, sustaining a relationship or a friendship with another person, anticipating hazards appropriately, following a one-stage command, addressing two people by name. Now, I'm sure most of you think of these things as very simplistic things, but the list comprises some very basic activities that are simple and require very little cognitive level interpretation to things that are much higher level, like being able to enter into a marriage, being able to raise children, being able to develop a budget. So what we wanted to do is present these things to an individual without any explanation, and there were three pages. The first one related to the mild level of intellectual disability. The second one was a moderate level of ID, and the third one was severe level of ID. So that each person, each respondent, was able to fill out the form three times. Okay. Now, the study design was very clearly defined. We had three groups of subjects. The first group are the people who volunteered at the event. What we asked them to do is, before there was any type of involvement with the athletes at the event, to sit down and complete the survey so that we got a sense of what they felt before they were involved with the vision screening program. This group was also surveyed 2 to 3 weeks after they returned home, with the intent that we were looking to see if there was a difference between the pre-survey and the post-survey, so that we had a sense of whether there was an impact of the screening. The second group was individuals who volunteered to participate at the screening, came, and they received the survey 2 to 3 weeks after the event. We wanted to leave that 2 to 3 weeks to identify what they remembered from their experience without it being a direct correlation to the actual day. Because oftentimes when you leave an event where you're doing something good, you're pretty excited about it and your perceptions may not be as accurate as if you had a little time to think about it. So that's why we had the delay. The reason we used this second group is we wanted to ensure that the pre-screening survey didn't influence the post-screening survey, because we were concerned that if we gave them that initial survey, that the way they worked with the athletes during the screening might have affected their outcome on the post-survey. So this is our second group. This is our true experimental group here. And the last group is our control group. What we decided to do is we utilized ICO, Illinois College of Optometry graduates, over a period of 40 years. We took 5 random individuals from every other year and sent them a survey. We did it under the auspices of a student research project and asked them to complete it, so that we had individuals who had not participated in the Special Olympics program. So here's our design. We have the group one, which is our experimental pre-post. We have group two, which is our screening post only, and we have group three, which is our control group. And we had 36 individuals in the first group, 63 in the second, and 65, which is actually pretty good, in our control group. The subjects were interesting to look at with respect to their demographics. Let's start with the control group. You'll notice that 84.6% of our control group is male, and 15.4% is female. The reason for that is, if you go back 20 years of alumni, the preponderance of graduates from ICO were male. It isn't until the last few years where you see a shift into the preponderance of students in the optometric program being female. And groups 1 and 2 were relatively similar, but there were definitely some differences that concern us. The other thing I wanted to point out is when you look at the age distribution for the three groups, group 1 is the mean age is 46.3, which is really interesting because many times if we do a screening in a city or location close to an optometric college, you end up with a heavier influence of younger people, which is our optometry students. So while the age range was 25 to 78, what we had was a number of people who were volunteering that were really at the older end, and they brought our mean up there. So we were really kind of concerned about our distribution of ages. So that we think that that's an important issue to address, and we did in our analysis. So there were 434 surveys total that were mailed or administered on-site. The on-site administration was simply the group 1. 171 surveys were returned, which is not a great return, but I suppose, you know, it's better than a 10% return. You know, you have to look at what you got and not what you don't have. In comparing the pre-screening survey and the post-screening survey using a two-way repeated measure analysis of variance, we found with group 1 that there was a positive difference in attitude as noted by the total number of things checked or the capability scores defined by the scores in the pre versus the post. So that states that the survey showed that the pre-screening survey, an individual checked lesser number of capabilities than the post-screening survey of the same individuals. The control group had lower capability scores overall for all three levels as compared to the experimental group when we took into consideration of age and gender being held constant because of the things I pointed out. We were very concerned about the differences in our demographics of the two groups. So one of the concerns we had is our control group different than those people who volunteer? And the reality is, yes, there is a difference. So let's go into a couple pieces of that. We compared our two experimental groups post-screening because we already know that people who came to the screening showed that their attitudes towards individuals changed. They changed in a positive manner, meaning that they thought they were much more capable, predominantly on the mild and the moderate level, and not the severe level of ID. And the reason being that people who participate in Special Olympics, the majority of the participants are those that fall into the mild and moderate level of intellectual disability. So we really haven't affected attitude with the severe level. The analysis of covariance looked at the possibility of differences between the three groups to see if they occurred differentially across all three levels. And we found that they didn't. Even though they didn't have any exposure to the severe level, theoretically it said that, or from a statistical standpoint, the changes were similar all the way through the three levels of ID. Here is the outcome from our data. The PBS is the prognostic belief scale, and the capability scores is how many out of 27. So the potential is someone would be able to do it to have a score anywhere from 0 to 27. The top number here is the mean, and the lower number is the standard deviation. Group 1 is the individuals who were pre-surveyed with post-survey. So let's look at the numbers here. Group 1 felt that the individuals could do 21 out of the 27 items before the exposure and 23.28 after the exposure. Group 2 had 21.98. Those are the experimental post only, while group 3 is the control group, where they only thought they were capable of about 20 items. Now, I have another column here that I wanted you to look at. The prognostic belief scale came out in the early 80s, and Woolrich et al. Did some studies on pediatricians with this exact survey. And what they found was that let's go back. What that 20 out of the 27 would be able to be attributed to those individuals with mild ID. So, interestingly enough, that our two experimental groups both had higher amounts, or what they thought that the individuals were capable of, than the pediatricians and the control group. So that's an interesting point. Group, when you go to the moderate level, you see the same types of things. Group 1 pre and group 2 post are pretty much the same, and group 1 post shows, it looks like an influence of having taken this survey earlier. But from a statistical standpoint, it didn't come out to be statistically significant. What they do show is that they are very different from the control group, which is 10.06, and the pediatricians, which is 10.3. The last group is where we found the least amount of difference, and that's the severe group. Obviously, you're not going to expect someone with a severe level of intellectual disability to be capable of some of those higher thought processes. The things that they really focused in on were daily existence of being able to feed yourself, being able to go to the bathroom, understanding an exit sign, some of those very basic self-help skills, they're actually taught in the educational programs. And those are the things that really were the only ones that identified at the severe level. The pre-group showed that they thought they could do 5.69. That same group retested only increased by about one item. The group 2 was very similar to the group 1 pre, which was 5.49. And the group 3, the control groups, dropped it down to about 4 items, which is pretty much what you would expect. And interestingly enough, our control group was very similar to the pediatricians in actually almost all of the items. And this is data that was published about 30 years ago. So our results suggest that the location of differences between the group was really assessed by the contrast effect. Group 1 pre differs significantly from group 3, as I noted. So that we really think that the people who volunteered are definitely different than our control group. Group 2 also differs significantly from our control group, suggesting that not only is it because they're volunteers, but also because their experience in the event suggested that they were influenced by working with this population. An examination of the impact of the two covariates on the dependent variable of the prognostic belief scale revealed that gender really had no effect on the PBA capability scores, because we were very concerned since there was a preponderance of males in our last group. Age did, however, have a significant effect on the capability scores, and I think you'll find this next piece quite interesting. What we found was that age was negative for all three levels of intellectual disability, suggesting that the age of the subject that responded increased as his or her capability score for the level of intellectual disabilities decreased. So the older that the subject was, the less they thought a person with intellectual disabilities was capable of. So in conclusion, we do feel that there's a value to participating, and we welcome anybody who would like to participate, and we do feel that age is an influence. So thank you.